the beauty of grazing is, like I'm going to do here in a minute, I'm going to get out and put up a single line, is you shut off the side-by-side, you're on foot out in your pasture, you're observing the grass, you're observing the forage, and it's hard to miss a bobolink that's singing above you while you're doing that, right? And for me, like, moving my cows to fresh grass, and there's days where I'll just sit down next to them and listen to them chewing, and then listen to all the birds and the meadowlarks singing, and it really sort of grounds you for the day.
Welcome to the 391st installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. When I started working for the Land Stewardship Project over 3 decades ago, one of my first gigs was to write about how a group of livestock grazers in southeastern Minnesota were working with scientists, natural resource professionals, sociologists, and economists, and others to develop a set of indicators for gauging the overall success of their farming operations. This initiative, which was called the Monitoring Project, was facilitated by LSP. It ended up having a significant impact on regenerative grazing, the soil health movement, conservation policy, and even how farmers balance quality of life with profitable production in a holistic manner. Perhaps the Monitoring Project's most surprising legacy was the connection farmers were able to make between regenerative grazing and healthy grassland bird habitat. With the help of Tex Hawkins, who at the time was a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, monitoring team members learned to identify grassland songbirds while moving livestock and doing other routine farm chores. It turns out, species such as bobolinks, stick thistles, and meadowlarks are what ornithologists call obligate species, meaning they require a certain amount of good quality, diverse grassland habitat to survive and thrive. And because so much grassland has been plowed up and planted to row crops in recent decades, grassland songbirds are some of the most threatened birds in North America. So if a farmer can find a way to make well-managed grassland economically viable, that's good news for birds, as well as pollinators and other wild residents. What the farmer members of the monitoring team learned was that the more grassland songbirds they saw on their land, the higher the probability that they were managing it in a way that grassland habitats were thriving. And the more high-quality grasslands they had, the better their beef and dairy cattle did. Once that connection was made, they started to take steps to improve life for their farm's feathered residents by, for example, adjusting grazing and mowing schedules to accommodate nesting seasons. I recently thought about all those hours I spent hiking grazing paddocks with members of the monitoring team while visiting Ashley Steinke on his farm in north central Wisconsin. As he and I rode in his Polaris Ranger side-by-side, he explained how over the years, he's converted a corn soybean farm into a grass-based grazing operation. Such a transition is definitely going against the grain in this part of Wisconsin, which, as livestock leaves the land, has seen a significant expansion of corn and soybean acres in recent years. Ashley and I rode through pastures full of diverse stands of grasses and forbs, and at one point stopped to watch his beef cow herd graze in one of his carefully set up paddocks. Ashley says there were zero grassland songbirds on this 340-acre farm when he bought it in 2014. Today, it provides prime wildlife habitat, he says, and Ashley knows of what he speaks. Besides being a livestock farmer, he's trained in wildlife biology and is currently a grassland ecologist for the National Audubon Society. In that role, his primary job is to work with farmers and other landowners in expanding the growth of the organization's wildlife certification program. Called Audubon Conservation Ranching, this initiative certifies livestock producers who are utilizing managed grazing systems that are considered bird-friendly. In other words, they're rotating their animals in a way that they are contributing to a diverse mosaic of grass-based wildlife habitat. The certification program started in the western U.S., and in recent years, Audubon has started working with Midwestern producers in states like Wisconsin and Minnesota. Hearing about a program such as this one is exciting, given that it provides farmers an incentive to create and keep in place well-managed grasslands. Just as importantly, it's an acknowledgement by a major environmental group that regenerative livestock production can play a key role in wildlife conservation. Finding a way to viably return soil-friendly perennial forages to the landscape isn't just good news for the birds. Ashley farms in the Yellow River watershed, which drains into the Chippewa, which eventually dumps its aquatic load into the Mississippi. Having deep-rooted perennials growing in areas like this can play a major role in keeping eroded soil, nitrates, and other agricultural pollutants out of our water downstream. While his cow herd bellowed impatiently for him to move them to a new paddock, which Ashley eventually did, we talked about what it was like to convert a row crop farm to perennial forages, ways he accommodates birds when managing rotations, and how programs like Audubon Conservation Ranching could bolster working lands conservation and help the general public find a way to support regenerative livestock farmers. Ashley also recalled the eye-opening experience when he saw his first bobolink on this former crop farm.
We really focus on timing of our grazing for grassland birds. So what that means is from like May 10th when we start grazing until August 1st, we're really intentional about how hard we graze certain paddocks. Mm-hmm. And what really drives that management is our bird surveys and where we see our greatest numbers of bobolinks and meadowlarks and savannah sparrows. So we look at our survey data and then we graze according to that to make sure that we're not mob grazing and trampling nests during the nesting season. I'll still lightly graze pastures because I think that bobolinks and meadowlarks go hand in hand with cattle, really. And if you're not putting a high stocking density, I think birds do pretty well on it. It really bears it out in your surveys when you're seeing, you know, 15 male bobolinks in a pasture in middle of June that you just grazed.
How do the cattle interact with the nests?
So just anecdotally, traveling around the state doing this job for Audubon, I hear so many ranchers talk about that they'll find meadowlark nests that are eaten around and the nest is still intact. Like those cattle know and can smell it or whatever, and they avoid those nests. With that said, there is research out there in Wisconsin that in heavily stocked pastures that there is trampling of nests that happens.
Yeah.
And it's really just becomes a function of your stocking density, I think, on how successful they are. But we take some of our best paddocks and we rest them completely during the nesting season. Like we don't even put an animal on them during the nesting season to see if that will have an effect.
Roughly what would be that nesting, what's that nesting season, the period?
Right here we consider it from May 1st until about August 1st or in that area.
So you said this has been your best grass year. How does that translate it to number of birds you've seen, or is that gone hand in hand, or is it too early to tell?
Yeah, so an interesting thing about this farm is where we're sitting right now, this was all corn and soybeans when we bought the farm.
Okay.
With the exception of the very marginal land along riparian areas that's too wet to farm, everything else was in crop ground. And when we bought this place, there were zero grassland birds on the entire farm. Last year, in 2024, when we did a bird survey here, we had 28 male bobolinks, 14 male eastern meadowlarks, something like 24 savannah sparrows, we had Brewer's blackbirds. So we've been increasing every year that we've increased our management and really focused our management. So I don't know that I can really say that, you know, when I say this was our best grass year, that was really from a perspective of cattle growth and cattle productivity. And we saw just as many meadowlarks and bobolinks this spring as we have any other year.
Wow. Yeah, what was that transition like from corn and beans into grass? I mean, that must have been quite a... How long did that take?
It was a process. The field we're sitting in right now is actually our first field that we seeded back in the spring of 2014. And then we continued to rent to a row crop producer for a few years. That really helped us foot the bill, right? We took any money that we made off that from a acre rental fee, and we put it all back into restoration on this place. In terms of the whole place was old, nasty barbed wire fence, and we tore all that out, put in wildlife-friendly fencing, seeded everything back to grass. By 2017, the entire farm was in grass. And so the entire farm has been in grass for 8 years now, and we've increased our grass and bird populations by that much already.
Yeah.
So it can be done, right? And grass and birds can colonize an area really quickly. They're really good at it. And then they're really easy to study. And they're really easy to count because a male bobolink, as you know, are pretty gaudy when they're out in a pasture flittering above you singing in the spring.
Do you remember when you went, okay, we're starting to see the birds come back? Do you remember that when that first happened?
I do. I remember the first bobolink, and I actually took a picture of it sitting on a barbed wire fence along the gravel road right down here. And I thought, how cool is that? That like it was actually from restoring this field back to grass that we finally had bobolinks show back up, and it was one. And I remember taking a picture of it standing on the barbed wire fence.
Uh-huh.
Wow. It was really an eye-opener of, like, what little changes on the landscape can make.
Because this is, it's not big, big corn and soybean country. I mean, you still see some hay and grass and that kind of thing, but it's... If you, it's infiltrated into this area.
Yes, and we've actually, even though this country we're at, heavy clay soils, our growing season shorter, we're growing more and more corn and soybeans in this township every year. And a matter of fact, right across the road on the neighbors, he used to be a small livestock producer, you know, had 10 or 12 beef cows, and so he had everything in hay, and he would make his hay late. He had an old tractor, an old hay bine that he cut hay with, and he retired 3 years ago, and it was great meadowlark habitat and bobolink habitat. When he retired, he rented it to another local farmer who has turned it all into corn and soybeans. And so we have definitely noticed a difference in grass and bird populations just from losing that.
Yeah.
Like, there's just not, there's still as many on our place, but you can just tell there's obviously no birds that are utilizing those cornfields and soybean fields anymore. So it's definitely a loss to our local community for grassland bird abundance.
And my understanding is, like, a bobolinks and maybe even meadowlarks and that, they're what they call obligate species. Like, they really have to have grass.
They do. Bobolinks and meadowlarks nest strictly in grass. There's research out there that shows kind of patch size that they need. And when we talk about patch size, it's how big of contiguous grassland acres do we need for a bobolink and a meadowlark to be a successful nester. And it also comes down to structure of those grasslands. You know, is it grassland that we plant like native prairie and then forget about it and only burn it once every 7 years because that structure becomes too old, too rank for those types of grassland birds to use anymore. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. I'll show you a native prairie that we have on here. And when we did our bird survey in 2024 with Audubon, that native prairie had zero bobolinks, zero meadowlarks, had a few sedge wrens, some red-winged blackbirds, and then across the road in our pastures that are being actively grazed, we had 23 bobolinks and 14 meadowlarks, and so it was really that disturbance on an annual basis that creates that really good habitat for those birds.
Yeah, talk more about that disturbance. What when we talk about like it's just doing continuous grazing, turning them out in the spring and bringing them in the fall. Yeah. This is a different kind of grazing.
So on our farm, we practice managed rotational grazing. Like the paddock that we're sitting in on the side-by-side right now has been rested for over 50 days. It takes a grassland bird a little over 30 days to initiate a nest, layer clutch of eggs, hatch it, and fledge her young. So when you take your cattle through a pasture, you lightly graze it, and there's a bobolink that's just finishing her clutch of eggs, and it's going to sit on them, and then you remove those cattle from that pasture and don't come back for 50 days, that gives her plenty of time to complete that life cycle of a nest. Now, with that said about managed rotational grazing, is there still is a place for continuous grazing for people that can't be on their farms every day doing this managed rotational stuff, and it's really about the number of livestock that you stock that farm with. If you're going to continuous graze and you stock it conservatively, that can be really good for grassland bird habitat.
What would be a typical... Because you're still trying to, you can't just always just defer to what's good for the birds. This has to be profitable for you as far as the cow-calf operation.
Absolutely.
So what would be an example of you going through a season trying to kind of balance that, I guess?
Yeah, so we talk about that all the time in our work with Audubon Conservation Ranching is truly we need the rancher more than the rancher needs us. So when we write habitat management plans for the Audubon Conservation Ranching program and how we operate on our farm from a business standpoint is everything has to work out financially. Because if it's not penciling out, then we won't be able to be here. Because if you can't pay your bills at the end of the year, you're not going to continue your operation. So what we do is we pick our areas that we know are low grassland bird abundance areas, and we keep that grass in a heavily vegetated state. So we'll mob graze it. We might even go in and clip it if we have to. And those areas are where we'll raise our yearlings that we're going to grass finish because they need the highest quality forage on the farm. And then the areas that we're really managing where our best grassland bird habitat is, we'll lightly graze or set it aside through the grazing season with our cow herd. Cows and heifers need a lot less nutritional value in their feed through the summer. So if we rest a pasture through July 15th or August 1st. We'll take our cows through that and mob graze it after the nesting season and then revegetate it, get it back to a leafy stage on the grass, and those cows do just fine. And so they're literally doing a job for us, and then they're raising a calf at their side while they're doing that. Mm-hmm. So it's really just picking apart your farm, making sure that you know where the best habitat is, utilize the areas that are marginal habitat for your best quality forage for your animals that are actively growing, and then utilize your cows for, and the kind of the joke we always say, or the adage that we always say, is your cows ought to work for you, and versus the opposite of you working for your cows.
Yeah. How big is your herd here?
Right now we're at about 17 adult cows or mama cows. And we're down a little bit right now. Our cow herd's getting a bit old, so we've been culling some of the older females, and we're starting to save more heifers back to grow that herd back. But ideally, this farm would support between 20 and 25 cow-calf pairs, and then we raise all of our calves up to finish at about 2 years of age.
So what's your market?
We direct market everything locally.
You do?
We do. Okay. Yeah, we have a walk-in freezer on our farm, and so we sell meat right off the farm.
Do you get a sense to the customers? Are they, obviously, if it didn't taste good, they wouldn't buy it, but are they drawn a little bit by the fact that it's helping grassland habitat?
You know, I think the biggest thing is we have customers that have been with us since we started this in 2014, and so the loyalty of our customers is really great. But also, you know, we really promote that when you buy beef from us, not only are you buying your food that feeds your family, but when you spend that money is going towards us providing this ecosystem and, quote, ecosystem services that we provide of clean water and wildlife habitat and pollinator habitat and just a really good, clean place on the landscape.
Yeah, what watershed is this?
This is the Yellow River watershed, which ultimately flows into the Chippewa River.
Okay.
And then Chippewa River is a tributary of the Miss.
Yeah. So what's the biggest water quality challenges in this area?
Yeah, so it's sort of changing as we speak right now. One of the biggest issues always used to be phosphorus loading into our lakes. And Lake Wissota, which is just south here, which we actually live on, is an impoundment. And it's, you know, impoundments fill up with sediment because the dams slow the water down. All that sediment coming down the river settles out. It's getting shallower. It's getting greener every year. But those phosphorus loads that I talked about, the data is showing that those loads are actually decreasing and getting to the point where we need them for water quality. But on the other hand, when you look at the graph, our nitrate pollution and our nitrate levels are going through the roof. So we're sort of trading one for the other at this point on the landscape.
Is the increase in nitrates is because of more corn and beans?
It is, yeah. Mostly corn.
Yeah,
corn. I mean, beans typically don't have any nitrogen applied to them, but our corn ground is needing more and more nitrogen every year to be able to grow a crop. And then we get into places like central and southwestern Minnesota and southern Minnesota, Iowa, southern Wisconsin, where everything is drain tiled now, everything's ditched, all of our wetlands are gone, and so the nitrates that filter through the soil end up in our water and head downstream.
Tell me a little bit, you kind of touched on this Audubon program, what are you doing with it, and what would be, when you're working with a landowner or a farmer or a rancher, What are you doing? Sure, it varies by farm, but what is the routine, the kind of the system you guys have down?
Yeah, so what happens is people express interest in becoming certified through the Audubon Conservation Branching Program. And what that does is that certification provides a bird-friendly seal that a producer can utilize in their marketing materials. They can put a big banner on their gate at their front entrance to their ranch. And then they can just use it as a sense of pride, right? That they're doing multiple things that a protocol states they need to do, from animal health and welfare to environmental sustainability, protecting riparian areas, protecting wetlands, and just doing a really good job with their grazing management for wildlife habitat, specifically grassland birds. So they get a hold of us and express interest, and we provide a visit to their farm. And then if we decide that, you know, it's in the right place in the landscape, there's enough grass that it's supporting grassland birds, then, and they agree to be certified through Audubon, as I write a habitat management plan for the farm. And then they actually, once that's complete, we write it with them. We pass it back and forth and make sure, going back to that, does it work financially? Like, it has to work for the ranch and their management. So we get that completed, and then that actually goes to a third party called Food Alliance, and they do a third-party audit on that ranch, and to make sure that they're following their habitat management plan as written out in the protocols for for the ACR program. And then in that habitat management plan, we identify ways that we can manage or restore grassland habitat to a better state on the farm to even increase their grassland bird habitat on the place. And in Wisconsin, what that looks like is removing a lot of woody encroachment off of farms, specifically tree rows. When you drive across the agricultural landscape, you see all these single row tree rows running through farms. And that's a remnant of our dairy industry when great grandma and grandpa put up barbed wire fence around every 40 and 80 mm-hmm. acre piece, and we stopped grazing and burning and haying underneath of them, and then trees grew up in those fence lines. Those trees are really detrimental to the health of a grassland. So removing those things, tweaking grazing management on the farm, looking at the best areas on the farm for grassland bird habitat and make sure we're managing that right. It's really pretty easy to do. Most grazers are doing a great job already, and it's just small tweaks that we can make to make it even better.
That's what I was wondering is when they, where these folks are on the spectrum as far as if they're just getting into grazing or if they're pretty well established. I'm sure it varies, but yeah, where are these, a lot of these folks at?
It does. It's people that just bought a farm in the last year or two, and they're really concerned about regenerative agriculture, regenerative grazing. They want to see birds and butterflies. You know, they're kind of that new generation. Mm-hmm. When I say the new generation, it's like my generation. I'm 44 years old and younger, that really care about this stuff, and they're utilizing that as marketing, that they're taking care of the landscape. Two, we have a gentleman being certified this week in Wisconsin that he's at the tail end of his grazing career. He's 70 years old. And he has just always, for the last 40 years, done a wonderful job grazing and cares about the birds and has just kind of always seen them as a byproduct of what he does. And his surveys actually showed of all of our ranches we're working on currently, it has the highest abundance of grassland birds on his place in the state. And it's just really his management. He's over on the Minnesota-Wisconsin line in St. Croix County, and just a super nice guy and just really fun to work with.
Oh, wow.
So it's a range of folks that we work with.
When you go in and do a plan then, like, again, I know it has to vary by farm, but what would be a typical setup that you would try to set up for them?
Yeah, it all depends. Like, I was on another longtime grazer last fall. Normally, we try to find a pretty big farm for Wisconsin, which is 100 acres or more, because then you have big contiguous grasslands. But like on this gentleman's place, he has 35 acres of grass, but it's on top of a ridgetop in the driftless area. And there's bobolinks and meadowlarks and all the grassland species, and has redheaded woodpeckers on the fringes in his oak savanna habitat. To guys that are running 500 acres in central Wisconsin, wide open grassland. So it really depends on the farm that we're at. In reality, no matter where you're at, it's kind of the same principles apply. Mm-hmm. You know, resting the best habitat, making sure we're not overgrazing that habitat, and then just animal health and welfare, that's part of our protocols, you know, making sure that we're not putting on harmful pesticides, you know, like ivermectin that has residual in the pasture for the bugs that are in the pasture, and, you know, things like that.
After they're certified, is there a yearly check-in?
There is. We actually have yearly check-ins. It's a year one audit, year two audit, year three audit to start.
Okay.
First one's in person, second one's a desk audit, and then the third one's in person. And we basically, that year three process is we set up goals in our habitat management plans of year one, year one might say better manage the grazing system and identify the best areas for grassland bird habitat. Year two, remove synthetic pesticides like ivermectin from the program and utilize other means of treatment that are better. And then year three might be, you know, removing tree rows. And so, like, we're not asking a farmer when he signs up to get everything done all at once, because that's not practical from time and resource perspective. So it's really a continuum of time and getting those practices done over 3 years. Ivermectin has a residual in it, so it stays in the body. So when they're defecating on the landscape, that actually stays in the cow patty, and it kills, like, dung beetles and other insects in the pasture.
Which the birds need.
Yeah, the birds need.
Okay.
So it kind of takes away the insect life in a pasture.
I know this has just gotten started here in Wisconsin, what, in 2023, something like that?
Yep, I came on July of 2023.
Okay.
So I've been here a little over 2 years.
All right. And so what, how many in this state, I guess, and maybe even in the Midwest, I know starting to do it in Minnesota as mm-hmm. well, but how many acres, how many farmers are we working with?
Yeah, well, right now we have about 60 farmers who are interested in becoming certified, over 10,000 acres. And it's just a matter of manpower to get all these visits done and habitat management plans completed while we're working on building out other grassland programs in the state. So we're going to get there soon. I think we're at the final stages of having 7 certified right now. But we'll be, you know, several more in the works. But total nationwide for the Audubon Conservation Ranching Program, we're at over 130 ranches and just over 3 million acres.
Wow.
That we've certified so far. And that Wisconsin is the only state east of the Mississippi that we work in. And everything else is west of the Mississippi in our range stage, which makes really good sense, right, to start. Because, you know, I talk about getting a 300-acre ranch in Wisconsin, and we're like, man, that's awesome. And then in a meeting, and you say that to our guys in Wyoming, and they kind of giggle, and they're like, well, we just certified one that was 100,000 acres last week kind of deal. And just
300 acres is where the farmstead is.
Right, so, right, yep. That's just the yard out there, right? So we got, you know, it started in the west, which rightfully so, because that's where our last remaining intact grasslands are, and that's sort of the most, I shouldn't say the most important, but a very important thing to keep those intact of what we have left.
Yeah, so the certification, like, for example, I could see this working out for you because you're direct marketing. So you can use this, say, look, I'm Audubon certified, and that would maybe draw a certain customer or whatever. Mm-hmm. Are a lot of these folks using that, or are they not there? Like, not everybody's direct marketing or is in markets like that.
Right, and one of the things that we do as an organization is we have a national marketing team. So if a producer wants to use the seal for that direct marketing, we have a team of folks that will work with them to create any marketing materials that they may want, from building a website to, we have a gentleman in central Wisconsin who's being certified right now. He sells at the downtown Dane County Farmers Market in downtown Madison. And he wants us to build him an 8-foot banner to go above his booth, because he has 50,000 people walk by his booth on Memorial Day weekend down there.
Wow.
And his thought is that him being Audubon certified will draw in a certain percentage of those attendees to that farmers market, and to help him do that.
That's one of the biggest farmers markets in the country.
Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately, though, it comes down to the marketer, right? And the producer of how do they want to use that seal? Is it more of a sense of pride, which a lot of people do? Or is it something you really want for your marketing to show you're doing right? And I think it's a little bit of both. But what I think is that almost everybody who's signed up through Audubon, through the ACR program, they carry a sense of pride with them that they're doing the right thing on the landscape. They're providing a quality habitat not only for birds, but also their cattle and their lifestyle of living on a ranch.
So some people might be surprised if they're not familiar with regenerative agriculture and kind of the changes that have occurred in the soil health movement and things like that. It might be a little surprised that a national environmental organization is promoting livestock grazing as a positive thing. Talk a little bit about that, how the Audubon Society maybe came to that conclusion that this is good for bird habitat, but also I'm curious when did things change maybe a little bit? I don't know enough about the history of, but I just know that in general, kind of the general ideas, well, no, the working farmland and environmental sustainability do not live in the same town.
it's pretty cool, isn't it? And, you know, not only Audubon is recognizing that a working landscape can provide really great habitat for wildlife and for birds. Most of the conservation organizations that we partner with, actually just today, when me and you go back to our Airbnb, a gal from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is going to be here surveying wetland restorations that we're going to do yet this fall.
Mm.
And they want us to graze the wetlands after we restore them because it keeps invasive species out. It promotes native species, the grazing. Audubon Conservation Ranching Program began, I think, in the year 2015 when it started. And what it really recognized is so many of our intact grasslands are owned and managed by families throughout the Great Plains. And anywhere we have grass now, I mean, we do have public lands that are in grass, but a lot of it's working landscapes, whether it's privately owned or owned by organizations like the Nature Conservancy. They're grazing cattle on so much of their landscapes that they own. And it was just really a nod to the ranchers in America that you guys are doing a pretty good job already of saving our grassland bird species. And if we're going to make a difference, we can't rely on just publicly managed lands mm-hmm. out there. And there's, and then we just took that idea, and you know, how do you reward that farmer or rancher for providing an ecosystem service such as grassland bird habitat? And I think that's how this kind of spawned. And you know, we're 10 years into it now, and you know, I think the proof is sort of in the facts, right? That we're at 130 ranches and 3 million acres and steadily growing. We're hiring new people right now. A job announcement just went out for a conservation manager in Iowa yesterday. We just hired Missouri. We're hiring more in Texas. We just hired in Kansas and Oklahoma. Wow. So like we're hiring in New Mexico. So we're just constantly expanding our footprint, working with ranchers throughout the entire Western United States. And eventually, you know, now we're east of the Mississippi in Wisconsin. And hopefully we can just keep growing that through any areas of our country that are cattle strongholds yet and have grass on the landscape.
The other thing that seems to have jived really well with, as far as timing goes, is the advancements we've made in managed rotational grazing. The fencing systems, the watering mm-hmm. systems, kind of just the managerial knowledge now of how yeah. these systems can work. That seems like it was a perfect storm that way, maybe, particularly here in the Midwest.
I kind of laugh a little bit because you read any major ag publication now and everything on the cover of every major ag publication is technology, right? And on this farm, I mean, you're looking at it. We got a one-strand electric wire separating this, and I'll put up another one-strand wire to separate a paddock. And so we're using electricity. Like, that's our technology that we're utilizing yeah. on this farm, right? And that technology is pretty old. And then we do have some one-inch black water pipe running everywhere to provide fresh water to these cattle. But other than that, like, the only equipment I own on this whole farm, 340 acres, is the side-by-side we're sitting in, and then a skid loader for moving hay bales around. And that is it that we own for equipment. Our haymaking, we custom hire out. I'm a big believer in community, and I think that working with custom operators that want the acres to work on, that's their niche, right? They can work with, you know, 10 grazers, don't have to own any equipment, and then you can have one custom guy that makes hay on all those 10 farms, and then he can make his money that way, and we make our money what we're good at, and it works out pretty good.
So as a wildlife biologist, you probably weren't taught, I'm making some assumptions here, that, yeah, livestock and wildlife go together, that kind of thing, but you were able to kind of see it, that it could work that way.
Absolutely. Like, when I was an undergrad at UW-Stevens Point, we didn't know anything about grazing. Like, we were never taught anything. And mm-hmm. fortunately, that's actually changing right now in the last couple of years. So when you're an undergrad at UW-Stevens Point, you have to go to a 6-week course at Tree Haven Summer Camp, which is in northern Wisconsin. And it's very intensive. Forestry, wildlife, fisheries. So you have like a week-long course in each. Well, there is a group of grazers that actually got with the university. And one of the weeks, every class has to go to a grazing beef farm. Huh. And they learn all about managed grazing, how it benefits grassland birds and pollinators and wildlife habitat, clean water. So we are now introducing undergraduate students in wildlife at UW-Stevens Point to the benefits of agriculture and this type of agriculture.
Wow.
So every one of them has exposure to it before they leave that program.
Yeah. I wanted to go back a little bit to the Audubon program. Have you did kind of bigger studies on, okay, this is the impact it's had on grassland birds, numbers, that kind of thing, and habitat overall? Have you been able to look at that?
Yeah, so we have a program, it's called the Bird Friendliness Index, or BFI for short, that our national science team takes our survey data from every individual farm, and it gets plugged into our BFI, and what that is, it spits out a number, it's kind of like a model, and that model is showing on individual farms that we are what we call bending the bird curve, is that we're able to increase the grassland bird abundance and density on individual farms and ranches. So what that means is, you know, we're proving out that this works, right? And this habitat stuff, grazing stuff works. Then you take that and you look at the patch size and you look at the landscape, and it ultimately comes down to landscape level conservation. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you connect those habitats to make a friendlier world for these birds to move about and to migrate and ultimately thrive back on the landscape. But yes, we have, so it's a science tool that we have that creates the model, and it is showing that we are we are increasing birds on individual ranches.
So can you describe to me, you were talking a little bit about this as we were driving out here, but describe to me what species we're seeing in this paddock here right now. What all is growing here? And I'm seeing bees and pollinators working it right now. We're here, this is the second week of September, I guess we're getting into.
Yeah, this farm is in north central Wisconsin, and it's on the north side of what we call the tension zone, which runs from northwest to southeast Wisconsin. And on the north side of that, and we're growing mostly non-native improved forage species like meadow fescue, timothy, orchard grass, red and white clover. In our pastures, I don't spray or clip for the so-called weeds, and we have a lot of flowering plants out here, from goldenrod to daisy fleabane. We allow our thistles to survive on the farm. So it seems like, you know, when you're out here, I've seen 3 monarch butterflies already since we've been sitting here.
Yeah.
And tons of moths, and when you walk through it, you're kicking up all these little insects. And so it's not native grass that we're in, that we're grazing, but all the other plants that we promote with diversity seems to do really good for our cattle health and the health of our wildlife and grassland birds on the place.
How big are your paddocks usually, and how often are you moving
them? Well, like, so today I'll build this paddock here in a second, which will take about a minute and a half, and move the cows in here, and that'll give them about 2 acres. And I'm actually going to give them 2 days of grass, namely because yesterday was my wife and I's 19th anniversary.
Oh, happy anniversary.
And thanks. She was out of town. And so tomorrow we're going to take off and we're going to spend the day together. So I don't want to have to do any farm chores tomorrow.
There
so
you go.
It's the beauty of managed grazing, is you can give cows enough grass to get them through a couple days. And there's even times if we go on vacation with the kids that we'll give them enough grass for 7 days.
Uh-huh.
And just have somebody go check on them, look out at the pasture, make sure they're okay. And that's what we do. And it provides a lot of flexibility to have a lifestyle and not be tied to the farm every day.
Yes. Back to the autumn program a little bit. Mix of producers that you're working with, I assume they're mostly beef. Is there some dairy involved?
So right now, for the actual certification, we only certify beef and bison producers.
Okay.
There's some USDA rules and other things for certification that we're working through to potentially get to where we certify small ruminants, and like goats and sheep, and then potentially dairy. We are working on a grant right now that we're successful, and we're surveying and providing technical assistance to organic dairy farms. So organic dairy farms require a certain percentage of their forage comes off of pasture.
Mm-hmm.
So we're providing technical assistance to interested dairy farmers on grassland birds, but we're not there from a certification standpoint yet.
Yeah, so what would be different about the dairy?
The problem with dairy in terms of grassland bird habitat is for dairy farmers to put milk in the bulk tank is they need really high quality forage in grass every day
uh-huh.
of the growing season. And so that means that they have to graze really tight, or they need to be going behind their cows and clipping their pastures. But one thing we are finding is there's a growing interest in grazing dairy heifers, and dairy heifers need very low nutritional value in their forage. So there's a real opportunity for acres on farms to graze dairy heifers for grassland bird habitat. And also there's some dairy farms that are grazing taller forages. I was on one about 40 minutes east of here this spring. They asked me to do a bird survey. Pretty big grazing dairy, or set of grazing dairies in a neighborhood. And they're grazing tall forages, and they're not making as much hay because they penciled it out where they can graze more and then buy their hay in. And it makes more sense for them to do that. And I think on their farms, we had like 47 bobolinks this spring.
Wow.
On dairy farms. So I think that model that family is proving out can be really successful going forward. And
yeah.
And they're a family that, as you should in a business like dairy farming, is they're putting the pencil to the paper and really sharpening their pencil on everything they do. And they're finding out that model's really working for them. And then what we found out, it's really working for grassland birds too.
Yeah, well, that's the brass ring, I would think, or the ultimate goal is to be able to show a win-win situation where the more birds you have, therefore I must have better forage, and mm-hmm. therefore I have better productivity with my livestock. Mm-hmm. That there's that kind of win-win-win, I guess, kind
yep.
of situation.
Absolutely.
Some folks are going to, I guess, approach this, like you said, they want to see more birds initially, or they want to see more grass. And so if there's a way that they can get that,
absolutely,
something like this can support them doing that, then it helps bring those yep. two together a little bit.
Absolutely.
One other thing is, for you, I get a sense, because you come from a wildlife biology background, it must make farming more enjoyable. And I wonder if to see the birds, and mm-hmm. you know, it's just part of the quality of life thing. But I'm wondering if you, the producers that you work with, if that's something that they talk about, it's just like, well, it just makes it funner to go out there and see those bobolinks or the meadowlarks and hear that and know that kind of things are working a little bit.
100%. And the number of farmers that I'm on their farms, and they bring out their phone and they actually open the Merlin app. Mm. And because they have a thirst for knowledge of what's in their pastures. Like, they really want to know what's out there. And you can tell that they're really paying attention to what's out there. And I think that the beauty of grazing is, like I'm going to do here in a minute, I'm going to get out and put up a single line, is you shut off the side-by-side, you're on foot out in your pasture, you're observing the grass, you're observing the forage, and it's hard to miss a bobolink that's singing above you while you're doing that, right? And for me, like, moving my cows to fresh grass, and there's days where I'll just sit down next to them and listen to them chewing, and then listen to all the birds and the meadowlarks singing, and it really sort of grounds you for the day and helps with that.
And you are able to make that, it's like, oh, the more birds I'm hearing, probably the more chewing I'm hearing, there's better forage.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, these cows are impatient. Maybe we should remove those.
It's funny, though. I can put them in here, and 12 hours later, if I was out here, they'd holler at me to move them again.
Of course.
For more on the Audubon Conservation Ranching Program and how regenerative grazing can support ecological health in a way that's economically viable for farmers, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 391 at landstewardshipproject.org. There, you'll see links to other podcasts on farms that are using regenerative methods to support wildlife habitat. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.